You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
This podcast has been commissioned and fully funded by Boehringer Ingelheim UK, including the preparation of the podcast article. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are the author's own and do not necessarily reflect the views or the position of Boehringer Ingelheim or any entities the speakers may represent.
Hello, I am Jill. I am a 40-year-old mother and wife from Aberdeenshire. I'm here today to tell you my journey as a sarcoma patient to help raise awareness of the disease and to amplify the sarcoma patient voice. Having never heard of sarcoma being such a rare cancer, I was never prepared for what was about to unfold in my life. In August 2022, after some routine tests and scans, my world was turned upside down when I was told that I had cancer. I was then faced with extensive surgery for the removal of the mass. This was sent to pathology, which confirmed my biggest fear of all, which came back to say, unfortunately, I had a grade 2 soft tissue sarcoma. I'd gone from being a busy working mum of two to not knowing what this meant, what the outcome would be, and where to turn to. Fast forward to 2024, and I am now passionate about raising awareness of not only sarcoma, but the difficulties experienced in my journey, with the ultimate aim to hopefully help others in a similar situation going forward. The lack of information about soft tissue sarcoma was my biggest challenge, and I will do anything I can to improve anyone else's journey facing this awful disease. I'm going to be joined by the lovely Sam.
Hello, my name is Sam Hackett, and I'm one of the Sarcoma UK nurses, and I'm really happy to be here today to help Jill tell her story and pull out some really important information for people about what sarcoma is. We're really going to be talking about the experience of people in the UK in the NHS system, but I think there's a lot of stuff that Jill will tell us and that we'll talk about that will be relevant for people across the world too. For this particular discussion today with Jill, we're going to be focusing on soft tissue sarcomas. So the aim of the podcast today is really to help educate healthcare professionals out there of the diagnosis of sarcoma and how to best support the people like Jill who are going through having to be diagnosed, having treatment and learning to live with the diagnosis afterwards. And we really want to help tell the story about how patients can communicate their needs and that healthcare professionals can really learn from the journey and what Jill is saying. So this is a great opportunity for us to raise awareness of sarcoma, get it out there to you guys as healthcare professionals and help you look out for the signs and the red flags to get people diagnosed earlier, because earlier diagnosis and sarcoma definitely saves lives. So what is sarcoma? So first off, sarcoma is a type of cancer, and that's really important because it doesn't say it in the name. So sarcoma is a cancer, and it's a cancer that arises in the connective tissue of the body. So we see it in fat cells, in muscle cells, in tendons, in bone. And because of that, you've got all of that connective tissue anywhere in your body. So we see them arise anywhere in the body. Most commonly, we see them in the extremities. By that, I mean the arms and the limbs, but we also see them internally. So we see them in the gynae locations. We see them in the back of the stomach. So they can occur anywhere. And the other thing about sarcoma is there are many different subtypes because you've got a lot of different connective tissue. So there are over 80 subtypes of sarcoma, and that makes it very difficult when diagnosis is being done because they can appear anywhere and sometimes they can look like other things. So most commonly, we will see them appear as a lump. And a lump that is growing and enlarging and changing is a classic red flag. Now, many people will have lumps on their bodies, and lumps are quite common, and fatty lumps are very common, and a lot of people will have them. But we are worried and concerned about the ones that are growing and changing in their nature. So perhaps they're becoming more painful. Perhaps the skin overlying the top of them is looking dusky or looking different, or if someone's had a lump in their past, maybe years ago, and that was removed and it's come back, that's a red flag. Non-cancerous lumps, when they're removed, stay away, they don't come back. When things recur, that's something to take, go down to the GP about. Jill had a gynecological sarcoma, and the red flags for gynecological sarcoma are different. We often see abnormal uterine bleeding. That's very similar to fibroids, which are very common. And we see many people being diagnosed originally with fibroids, which sometimes turn out to be a gynae sarcoma. They get usually picked up further along after further tests or an ultrasound, but an MRI is probably more useful for uterine leiomyosarcoma. And we're going to talk about this a bit more as we go through what happened with Jill and her experience. So soft tissue sarcoma is difficult to diagnose. It does take people a long time sometimes to reach the specialist sarcoma team, which is where we need them to be cared for. 79% of patients diagnosed with sarcoma have not heard about it before. And most general practitioners, GPs, will expect to see maybe one or two patients in the whole of their working lives. And many patients will see a healthcare professional like a GP or a physio three times before they get into that diagnostic pathway. So it's really important for us that we raise this awareness. We know that many clinicians really lack the understanding of sarcoma because they don't see it. And it's really important that when people are presenting to the GP with a lump that is growing, that is one of those red flags, that the GPs know to think, I need to do something about this. There is a change. I need to arrange an ultrasound if it's soft tissue. And I need to think about what that ultrasound is showing. And it might well need to be referred on up for an MRI. We know that patients need to get, if there is an abnormality and a suspected sarcoma, up to the sarcoma specialist centres, and that's key. And we know that it's the sarcoma specialist centres across the country that need to make the decision plans on treatment. The majority of soft tissue patients will have surgery as the keystone of their treatment, but sometimes we add in chemotherapy if the cancer has spread to more than one location. And we often add in radiotherapy, which is X-ray treatments, before we do our surgery. More recently, there has been more novel therapies that are more targeted to sarcoma. That includes radiofrequency ablation and more targeted drug treatments as well. But we know for patients with sarcoma that the journey to being diagnosed is very difficult. And we're going to talk more with Jill about what happened when she was trying to be diagnosed. We know from Sarcoma UK's National Sarcoma Survey, which was done in 2020, that nearly a quarter of patients started their treatment for an incorrect diagnosis before receiving their correct sarcoma diagnosis. For a patient diagnosed with soft tissue sarcoma, they are confronted with many challenges and anxieties and frustrations as they navigate this difficult clinical journey at times. We know we really need more research focused on the needs of the patients with sarcoma. It's very limited. We don't often hear the patient's voice in this journey. And consequently, we can't really, you know, understand their experience. And what we want to hear and listen to today from Jill is her experience. We know it's crucial to really promptly identify patients who may have soft tissue sarcoma and get them referred to the specialist sarcoma centers so that they can really receive their optimal multidisciplinary treatment. Jill, I wonder, can you describe your experience from that initial point when you thought something's not quite right on to how you got that diagnosis of soft tissue sarcoma?
Yeah, so for me, scarily enough, Sam, I actually had no symptoms at all that would make me think I need to go and visit my GP for something, other than I did have some lower back pain, which in hindsight now had probably been going on longer than it should have been. But put it down to kind of just sitting, had a desk job and being busy with the kids. So it was actually a routine smear test that picked up some abnormalities, which led to me being sent for further tests. I was told that my referral would take several weeks due to the waiting lists. So initially, I actually went private to see if it would speed up the process, obviously in a very worrying time and wanting to get answers quite quickly. The private appointment was actually ended up being a 5-hour appointment, which included scans, examinations, a lot of could be's, might be's. But the answers weren't very concrete and I didn't really know very much. At this point, they thought I had, from the external scans, 3 very large fibroids, but they said that they would need to further investigate it, mainly because of the size of them and the location as well. So at this point, I was then sent from my GP to the Women's Day Clinic here. So this was the NHS appointment, where it was also thought there that it was fibroids. They did think that also at that appointment, but again, they weren't sure. So I would require an MRI to confirm this. So it was kind of back on the waiting list and a bit of a waiting game again for that appointment to come through. After waiting a few more weeks for that, the MRI appointment came through, got that done. And then it was having to wait for the results of the MRI. That's another big waiting game that I felt in between. So I waited for that, and then it was later transpired that it had taken so long for the results to come through because, as you touched on before, it had to go to the MDT meetings, which I was told there was lengthy discussions as they were all still very unsure as what it was. But then I did get that dreaded call to confirm that it was cancer and that surgery would need to be planned ASAP. I found this whole process personally very stressful. I found I was being passed from pillar to post, but I also found it frustrating because I didn't really know what I was dealing with, where to turn to, and the lack of information, because I really couldn't find very much on it. I know they say the worst thing you can do is Dr. Google, which of course I did Dr. Google, as we all do. But all the information that I was finding on sarcoma was either not an awful lot or really outdated information that I found on there. So that did make the initial part of my journey quite frustrating.
About 23% of patients presenting to their GP and being diagnosed initially for something else. And that, I think, is sometimes definitely where we see the delay. But patients also don't know when they should seek help. And so raising the awareness of the signs and symptoms is really important, but it can be very vague. As Jill said, you know, she really didn't have any symptoms. When she looks back, she thinks she might have had back pain, perhaps a bit longer, but there was nothing that really raised a main concern for her. And I think that is some of the problem with the delays. Another important point for us is the complex nature of sarcoma. We've already spoken that there are 80 subtypes of sarcoma, over 80 subtypes, and that they appear in different parts of the body. So it is very hard when you present to a healthcare professional with something. They would never have seen someone with that symptom, probably for that lump for a soft tissue sarcoma before. But we need a robust process. I don't expect a GP, when someone rocks up with a lump, to think, oh, I think this is a sarcoma. What I want them to say, this doesn't fit. Why is this lump growing? Why is it changing? What do I need to do as a GP? I need to do something to investigate what this lump is. And for soft tissue, it's very simple. We just need an ultrasound. Now, that works well when someone's got a lump on their arm or their leg or even on the outside of their belly. It wouldn't have worked for Jill. She needed an internal ultrasound to start that process. And actually, she needed an MRI. It was the MRI in Jill's story that got that diagnosis, that made people look and think in that big MDT discussion, what's going on? It's not yet known what makes it a uterine leiomyosarcoma as opposed to maybe a fibroid on most scans like an ultrasound or a CT. In this situation, we think that MRI is much more helpful. And Jill described that her MRI was the key to her getting diagnosed. In addition, recent ARCOG guidelines have highlighted red flags being more specific to gynecological conditions that can kind of help differentiate between what might be a fibroid and what might be sarcoma. The main issue caused by delay in diagnosis is that if people aren't getting in at the front end and getting a quick diagnosis, they don't get to the sarcoma teams early enough. And it's the sarcoma teams, like we've said, that make the decision and the plan of treatment. The ultrasound will often say, this looks like an unusual lump. It needs further investigation. It won't say it's a sarcoma. It will say it needs further investigation. And it will highlight the need for an MRI. And then the MRI will say this potentially is a suspected sarcoma and the patient needs to be referred directly to a sarcoma MDT. And we want that process to be as quick as possible because then the patient gets to treatment as quickly as possible. The case will be discussed in the sarcoma multidisciplinary meeting, which we've discussed before. These are meetings where it brings sarcoma specialists together. So there are clinicians, so oncologists, surgeons, nurses, physios, histopathologists. They're all in a room, often 20 people, making these really important management plans for patients with sarcoma. For you, Jill, following your diagnosis, how would you describe that experience through the various stages of your treatment?
Well, for me, Sam, even once I was told I would need my surgery to remove my mass, it still felt like I didn't really know what I was dealing with as such. I was told by my surgeon that there was still a lot of ifs and buts, and even what surgery would have to be carried out really depended on what they kind of find once the surgery was underway. So that was a bit daunting, not really knowing. So I still felt this massive frustration at this point because I still didn't really know what they were dealing with, what was going on, but obviously it had to be done. But all we really knew was there was very large masses that needed to be removed as quick as possible. So for me, surgery itself, unfortunately, didn't go very well due to some complications. A huge blood loss, which actually resulted in having to get 8 units of blood. So it took quite a toll on me. And I ended up in ICU for a few days, ending up with an 11-day stay in hospital. That said, my surgeon was amazing and kept me very informed of what had been done on helping me in the recovery process. But even then, I was back to the waiting game of 2 weeks to wait for the pathology results to come through. Just for them to confirm, was it, wasn't it? You know, I still wasn't sure what was going on there. So after that 2-week week, that's when they did confirm that it was a grade 2 soft tissue sarcoma. Unfortunately as well, they did confirm that all of the clear margins were not obtained during the surgery. So I was told that after I had recovered from the surgery, that I would require radiotherapy.
Radiotherapy is a really interesting tool for sarcoma. We often use it alongside the surgery. And it's sometimes we give it before we give radiotherapy before the surgery. Patients find that quite hard because they just want the lump out. But we know that if we give radiotherapy before, sometimes we can give it less of a dose, and that's important. But actually, for some people, more commonly with the gynae sarcomas, we do the surgery, we check for those margins because surgery is all about getting clearance. And if we haven't got good clearance around the edge, then we add in radiotherapy. An extra thing to have done though, at the end of surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. But that said, it was actually at this point that I was then referred to the specialist sarcoma team, both here in Aberdeen and also a team in Glasgow, as it was believed at this point that I would actually require more surgery because of this clear margins, and they didn't actually know if everything had been removed. So that was also a little bit daunting. But I did at this point feel a little bit more in control, as even though I was obviously devastated at the news that they had confirmed it. And I had a team who specialised in this, and I had a contact who I could go to with any worries, etc. So I had my consultants, but I also had my CNS nurse, who was the lovely Rachel.
The amazing Rachel. And there are amazing versions of Rachel across the country, because that key role, which is a clinical nurse specialist in sarcoma, is the vital person. I think she's the linchpin, or he, the linchpin in your care. Hey, they are the person that you go to. They're the person you can ask questions, but their role is to get you through that pathway, to be there, to make sure you're on track. And I often hear from patients that I talk to that the moment they meet the CNS is the moment they feel, oh, I found someone that knows about sarcoma. I found someone that can answer my questions. I found someone that can walk alongside me through this journey. And it is a very important moment. And it comes because in that specialist team, they sit right in the middle of the sarcoma specialist team. They know everyone, they know everything, and they can be that amazing resource that I'm sure Rachel was for you.
Absolutely. And as you say, it was my, even to me, thinking silly questions, where do I go to? I knew Rachel was on the other end of a phone or an email for anything, and she would get straight back to me, or appointments or scans or anything where I didn't know where to chase up. She was always, and still is, there, hugely beneficial to me, and really helped ease some of that stress that was obviously incurred at that time. But it was 3 months after my surgery, after being referred, that I started the 25 sessions of the radiotherapy, which is quite full on because it does consist of going in every day for the sessions. During the radiotherapy, I had no real side effects from it, other than being really tired. But I felt I was given a lot of information on the radiotherapy, with it being booklets and what to expect, how long the sessions would last, and what side effects to look out for. So I find all this really helpful at this point, that I was now getting the information on what I was going through and what the treatment would do. Also made some really good friends during this time. I, with being there every day and the other people being there at the same time every day. So there was some good coming out of a bad situation at that point.
I think that also goes back to that very key point that those sarcoma MDTs are absolutely key, because the sarcoma MDT sits in a sarcoma center. So when you go, you suddenly have all of this support, you know, you have, you meet the other people as around you, but you also have all the clinical teams. They all know what they're talking about. Most people will say until they get to the specialist team, no one's ever heard of sarcoma. No one knows what to say to them. It's such a shame that for you and for many other people, that took 3 months for you to get there. I want you being there in about 6 weeks, not three months. And I think that's important. And I wish for you they had been much earlier. You'd got your Rachel much earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. Huge turning point in my journey there. Because then after the radiotherapy, I was then put on to 3 monthly MRI scans to keep an eye on things, but also CT scans for my chest and lungs as well, to keep an eye on that as well. And thankfully, after the radiotherapy, it was decided that I would not require the further surgery in Glasgow, and that the radiotherapy had done its job, which was obviously a massive relief that no further surgery was required at this time. So that was obviously a huge relief.
And I think that follow-up brings anxiety as well, because we know that for sarcoma patients, the follow-up regime is a little bit different depending on where your sarcoma was. We always do something that looks at the original site. So for some people, that could just be us looking where the lump was. And for other people, it means an internal scan. But we also know with sarcoma, we're always looking just to check it hasn't spread. It can spread, and that's what cancers do. And for most patients with sarcoma, that's to the lungs. So we usually follow up with a chest X-ray to look for metastatic disease. But also, of course, follow-up involves you getting on with your life. Follow-up is not just looking at the physical things. It's hopefully looking at all of you. And that's why the people like Rachel are so important.
That emotional support as well, absolutely.
So Jill, can you share how the soft tissue sarcoma diagnosis has kind of impacted your daily life and sort of the relationships away from the clinical setting? What's it really been like for you living with this diagnosis?
I think it's impacted every single aspect of my life, if I'm honest. As soon as you hear the C word, everything changes, not only for you, but for everyone else around you in your life. I felt hugely isolated during this journey, as no one really knows what you're going through, as it's a personal journey, but also with the lack of information available about it. and I couldn't really understand the whole thing myself to be able to digest it all. It was obviously really then difficult to try and support everyone else around me to help them digest. Self-esteem, I think, is also affected from the physical effects, not only the scars from surgery, but also the loss of fitness, etc. As it's something that I've been able to work on and build back up. And also your mental health as well, I think it also has a bit of effect on. But obviously, I'm quite a positive person. I try to keep as positive as possible about everything. And I do think that helps. I do think if you can try and remain as positive as possible, that it does help, because you can't change what's happening to you. You can only try and remain as positive as possible and hope for the best outcome on it all. So I think, yeah, it's every kind of aspect, even your working life or your personal life and your friends. And, you know, there's always this kind of doubt in the back of your mind as well, I think.
I think that that loneliness that we know from work we've done with Sarcoma UK, that it is very often described as the loneliest cancer. And I think what you're saying is that, you know, when someone's often diagnosed with a common cancer, they'll know someone else. So if you get a diagnosis of breast cancer, people will know someone else that's had breast cancer, or someone down the street, or a neighbor. No one's ever met anyone else that's had a sarcoma until you get to that specialist center. You never meet anyone. And people do always describe exactly what you're saying, that you feel very lonely in it. That there's no information, there's no other people with it, no one's talking about it. I think that that is definitely something quite unique to sarcoma, that sense of feeling lonely. But the impact as well on the family, and it's really interesting how you describe that you need to understand it before you can help the people around you understand it. And I think that's really key. I think as healthcare professionals, we often forget that the person in it is the patient, but they're also all these other roles in their normal life. Their mum, they're a partner, they're a best friend, and that all those people want to know what's going on with you, and you have to share what's going on with you sometimes, maybe when you don't want to or you don't even know how to share it. People describe that really often to us, how difficult that is.
Yeah, if you're not understanding it yourself, then it makes it impossible to try and explain it, especially to like my children or younger people as well. It's like it's a hard enough situation that mum's ill, you know, or something's going on, but to actually not be able to have the answers to explain it more to them. I personally find that very difficult in the whole journey, but try also to remain positive for them. So yeah, it has had an effect in that way.
Jill, we were talking earlier on about the involvement of the lovely Rachel, the CNS in your care was so important. Tell us a bit more about what Rachel was able to offer.
Rachel, obviously, clinical nurse specialist for me, felt like a massive helping hand in my journey. I was obviously so lucky with her to be there. And like you said before, walk alongside me in each step of the journey, which I felt was a massive help. She was there for guidance when I needed it, where that be just listen to me or advise me on things, be a shoulder to cry on if I just had really silly things that I wanted, that not to burden anyone else with at home. I knew I could go to Rachel and ask her her questions. I think the collaboration between a CNS nurse, a patient, and wider healthcare is so, so important. I think they play a vital role for all patients going through this.
I absolutely agree. I think that CNS is the absolute linchpin in the sarcoma service, full stop. They are the person that makes sure that the patients get through their care and they are supported. But they also are the person that communicates with all members of the team, whether they're in the hospital or the team in the community for you or the palliative care team. They are the people that they are your go-to, and they're so, so very, very important. And I think that relationship that you build with them is important for the family as well. And I think as well, you've accessed the support groups, haven't you? How did you find that? Has that been helpful?
Yeah, so there was no support groups up here in Aberdeen. So Rachel and myself and a few others actually started an Aberdeen support group here.
And that's specifically for sarcoma patients, isn't it?
Yeah, for sarcoma patients. But I found even at attending these meetings, the huge variety of different patients that were there, that it wasn't just people going through the same journey as you. There was amputees, there was, you know, people, obviously there's the bone, sarcomas as well, soft tissue, but it opened up this even bigger thing that you realize that there's so many different cases of it affecting so many people in different ways. It's still difficult to still find someone within the support group who can really relate to your journey, but it's definitely needed when there's nothing in this area for it. So hopefully it can give some comfort to people going through this journey as well.
So Jill, looking back over your journey to where you are now, what do you think we can learn from to try and improve for the next people having their treatment?
I think the likes of the aftercare, I felt there was a big lack of information on physiotherapy education, what's advised that I can and can't do after surgery, because I think for me, it wasn't a straightforward surgery that's in a leaflet to tell you can lift this, or you can do that, or you can walk this far, or you can run after this amount of time. There really wasn't that information. So I really struggled with things like that.
So needing that clear information following your surgery and your radiotherapy to know how you can start looking after yourself to get back up to where you wanted to be to rehab is important.
Yeah.
And did they do a holistic needs assessment on you where you asked you to fill in a form to address all of your needs?
Not initially, but I did have to do one at a later point.
They're a very useful tool, a holistic needs assessment. They are part of the cancer patient's journey. And the reason we do them is to pick up on the needs of the patient, not just the physical needs, but the other needs that you might have, to address the psychosocial needs, sexual needs, questions about family, all of that stuff that sometimes we don't always ask the questions, and all people don't always like to bring up themselves. And so the holistic needs assessment are a way of ticking a quick box, which gives the nurse the opportunity to pick up those needs along the way. And did you find that there were specific things that you felt were missing in the care or in the information people gave you, or maybe people's knowledge?
Yeah, I think lack of knowledge, obviously, because it's so rare, was quite a bit of a challenge for me. But also the needs for things that I was asking for, like I've touched on, the physical fitness, physiotherapy and nutrition, all that kind of things, I think would be quite helpful afterwards to help you, or during treatment, like radiotherapy. Is there things that I should be doing, or eating, or all these kind of things? So I think education for healthcare practitioners and patients, I think, is needed on this, just to make people kind of aware of it, and maybe to build up a network for both the patients and the clinical nurse and nurse specialists as well would be quite a good thing to have.
I mean, I think there is a lot of work being done. It's definitely a need that we as a charity know, Stockholm UK know about, and nationally, that we need to raise awareness and educate people about sarcoma. So there's some amazing tools out there. There's Gateway C, which is an actual tool specifically for GPs around sarcomas and early diagnosis. It's targeting those professionals working in primary care to look at lumps and bumps in a different way and think sarcoma, which is what we want. There's also some diagnostic toolkits that go out to GPs that Sarcoma UK work on, which just says, if you've got this lump, this is what you should do. Ultrasound and MRI, like we've spoken about before. And I think bringing nurses together and clinicians together is really important for sarcoma. So they share their knowledge and they share their experience, but bringing the patients as part of that process is really important. And if I'd had the information booklet, that would have been great. And I think signposting patients early on in their pathway to charities like Sarcoma UK and some of the other ones where you can get very specific information that says sarcoma on it, that says this is for sarcoma patients, this is written with sarcoma patients in mind and with sarcoma patients, to really understand what it's like and what you need. Also to remember that sarcoma patients are followed up for 10 years. And so the anxieties and the concerns stay with people for that time, and also longer sometimes, and that you need people educated in that and the knowledge of that to help answer the question. So that linchpin comes back in, that Rachel, that support group, the involvement with the sarcoma community at the specialist centres and outside with the charities is so important.
I definitely agree. And I think if, you know, like you said, planting the seed about diagnosis is obviously something that we really want to try and emphasize for clinicians, that hopefully it does maybe hold at the back of their mind that could it be this, that this is obviously a massive aim for us to do as well, like you say, for it. But yeah, I think the connection between all the clinicians and educating together would be a massive help. But because I remember us discussing this before, and you go and see different health professionals, and every time you're seeing a new person, I'm a specialist.
You are.
And then it's like, it feels really backwards, because it's like you're going to this person for help, but they've never seen this before. Do you know? So it's all new to them. And then you're coming in as a patient, you know, explaining it to them as your story.
I completely agree with you, Jill. I hear that all the time, that you are an expert in sarcoma. And very often when you're outside of the specialist centre, when you meet the GP again, or when you have the district nurse come in after your surgery to have a look at your wound, we'll never have heard of sarcoma. You are the person that will have the most knowledge. And you're absolutely right. The patients are crucial, because they are talking about their disease and they're raising awareness. But it's also very scary that you're in a centre, when you leave the centre, you're back to educating everyone because no one's ever heard of it. It is. And we hear that all the time. So Jill, you know, when we talk through your journey and your experience of sarcoma, there's lots of things that come out to me around that important need to get to the specialist teams. And I wonder, you know, when you think back, what kind of your three biggest key points that you think were important for you to get on with treatment and get to the right place? What made a big difference for you?
I think the major key point for me was when I met Rachel, my CNS nurse. That for me, that was a massive turning point in my journey. To feel like you had someone there, along with obviously your special sarcoma team. And also a key point, I think, as well, that patients should all then get access to the sarcoma support groups as well, that I wasn't so aware of at the beginning, obviously, because we didn't know what we were dealing with. But I think that's also a big key point for me as well, just having that access to people.
I think that is so important, getting into the specialist teams. We know 13% of patients never get there. And I think that is the crucial part, because with the specialist team comes the versions of Rachel, comes the versions of the support groups or the links to the support groups. And so I think all patients need to get to the specialist teams early enough. I think they need that linchpin of the Rachels of this world. I think the access to the support groups is vital, like you've so eloquently explained. And Sarcoma UK's information and the support line gives an extra layer to the information coming from the specialist teams. It's like a backup for the specialist teams. And I think, you know, you spoke earlier on about the need for not just the physical stuff, but the mental, the support for your mental health and your well-being is so important.
I just want to thank you so much for letting me share my journey today. I hope it can help any other patients facing this awful disease. I also want to thank Sam for her guidance today, and also to highlight the importance of the key points here.
And I'd like to thank you, Jill, for sharing your journey. I know how difficult it can be to keep retelling your story, but we've learned so much from you today. And I think, I hope that the people listening to the podcast will take away from this that it's so important to get patients diagnosed with sarcoma quicker. We know that late diagnosis or misdiagnosis impacts outcomes. We want those patients up to the specialist teams to get the treatment that they need as quickly as possible, because we know that even patients diagnosed quickly and treated successfully can face the physical and mental after effects and those life changing and that sense of isolation that you've described so eloquently today. And I want those patients up in the specialist sarcoma teams as soon as possible so that those, all of their needs can be met. Thank you so much for listening to us today.
Boehringer Ingelheim, job bag code SC-GB-02427. Date of preparation, February 2025.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.